This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 7th.
Wow. Excellent. 100% correct so far. Very good. Yes. The client contacts the server. The client usually has a fixed address and the server has different addresses at different times. Okay, if you're not keeping up with the material by reading it between classes, there are a few people who are not getting this, right? No answers. Next. They get subtler as we go along. TCP is ideal for multimedia applications because it provides accurate delivery. Right. Well, let's think about TCP. I mean, I say a name, you got to think about what's in it, right? What is TCP? A reliable transport protocol, right? Which means that all of the bytes that are sent get delivered in order, and we talked about how achieving that could lead to situations where if something is lost along the way, TCP has to wait to catch up, right? So do you think that provides accurate delivery timing? Not particularly. And the internet as a whole doesn't make any guarantees about delivery throughput. Right? We say it's best effort, which means that the network is free to do what it does, and you're free to take your business elsewhere if it doesn't do what you want it to do. Most of the time, it does pretty good at what you want it to do, so we are able to do Netflix and Hulu and YouTube and all that stuff, but there are no guarantees. Okay, so moving on to the application protocol, HTTP is a stateless protocol. Okay, yes. It is a stateless protocol, which means that the server doesn't remember anything about what the client is doing from one request to the next. It just does what the client says within the protocol. There are ways, and we're going to talk about them later today, for the server to remember things about clients, but that's not part of the HTTP protocol. It's sort of outside of the protocol. All right. Okay, we talked last time about persistent HTTP and non-persistent HTTP, and what's the advantage here? George is correct. The advantage is that we can transfer multiple files over a single TCP connection. And why is that an advantage? I didn't ask that, but what is it that makes that an advantage? Somebody want to volunteer? You don't have to set up a new connection every time, And therefore, you can make all of your requests for a page at one, essentially one right after the other without waiting in between. So, yeah, so it goes faster. All right. Well, that's all the questions for now. We may come back and do a couple more at the end if we have time. But thanks to Redmond, we've wasted some time, so we'll see. Okay, so this is where we left off last time. And we were about to get into the details of the HTTP protocol. So HTTP is an example of a protocol that uses ordinary ASCII characters to carry the messages that make up the protocol. And so you can actually look at these messages and say they really look exactly like what you see here, in the sense that you can see the word get there, and you can see the slash, and you can see the name of the thing you're getting, and the HTTP 1.1, and all that stuff. Just looks exactly like that if you look at the data on the network. The protocol defines several different kinds of messages. There are request messages and response messages, and we'll go through the request messages, some of the request messages first, take a look at what they look like. So, a HTTP request, one of the kinds of requests is a GET request, and it takes the keyword GET, and then the path to the thing that you're retrieving on the server, and then there's this convention that says, or requirement that says, you have to say what protocol you're using. And notice that the blanks here are significant. So what happens if there's a blank inside the URL that we're going to get? What do you think we have to do? What's the usual thing you have to do when you have a character that in programming, you have a character that somehow doesn't correspond to something you could ordinarily run as a single ASCII character, right?
You have to
escape it somehow is what I'm going for, right? And in HTML, the way you escape characters is you write down their hex codes with a special character in front of that. Okay. Yeah.
Is that also like my code?
No, it's not what we would call bytecode. Bytecode is a programming language idea for writing pseudo machine code.
Okay.
No, this would just be called an escaped character. We'd write it with an ampersand and the hex value 20, I think it is, if we had to put a blank in there. So the blanks are significant. And notice that the line ends with the escape sequences, carriage return, and new line. I don't know why they went with the Microsoft convention for this and required two characters at the end of the line, but they did. So every one of these lines is going to end with those two characters, and those are written in the those are written here with the backslashes, meaning that those are really the character codes for carriage return and new line. A single byte is in for these. Just like there would be a single byte in your C program if you wrote backslash R or backslash N. Okay? So you've got to have that line, and then you've got to have a so-called header line. This one is required, that says host colon space, and then the name of the server that you're retrieving the file from. Don't put that in. Some servers get upset. And that one ends with carriage return new line. And then come a bunch of different headers. Each one has the name of the header and a colon, and then the value that's associated with that header. And different headers, of course, take different values. We're not going to go into those too much at the moment. This one here, Connection Keep Alive, we'll come back to in the final project. We'll have a lot to say about Connection Keep Alive. It's basically the thing that says in HTTP 1.1 that we're going to use the feature of reusing the connection. If you don't put that in, it will assume that we're not going to use the feature, and it will just close the connection when we're done. Okay? So that one ends with a carriage return new line, and then that there's one more carriage return new line, a blank line that indicates the end of the headers. Now, in a simple GET request, the end of the headers corresponds to the end of the request. That's all there is. But there are other requests that then will have a request body that follows after this. So, this is even really Microsoft PowerPoint that's displaying this. So why the red line goes through? Oh, so our way of describing such protocols is often to give these diagrams that show how they're laid out. So here the method is get or put or whatever, and the space I mentioned, and then the URL on the server, another space, the HTTP version string, the carriage return, and the line feed. All right? So we'll draw pictures that look like this a lot of the time. Notice, again, the blank line here followed by the body. Any questions about that? It's a pretty simple idea. You just need to get used to looking at those diagrams. Later when we do UDP and TCP, we'll be doing diagrams like that that are sort of very rigidly 8 bytes wide and have essentially binary values in them instead of character values. But it's a good practice. Yeah?
So like all browsers have this sort of thing built into them whenever you send a request to a specific URL?
Right. So when you type into your browser a URL in the address bar and hit enter, what the browser does is it formulates essentially a message that looks like this and sends it to the web server. Okay? Okay. In addition to the get method, there's a post method. When you're working with a web form, where you actually supply data and then make your request, like the clicks forms, for example, are examples of this. You supply some data that then gets sent to the web server. There are two methods of doing that. One is called the post method, and you know that post as opposed to get. And then the other method actually sticks that input into the URL itself. Using the question mark separator to say that's the end of the main URL, and here come the things that I'm supplying as the additional values. So you can do that with get method. What do you suppose is the motivation, or what is a motivation for not always using this version, right, where we stick the stuff that we filled into the form into the URL. Go ahead.
You have a lot of data in the form.
A lot of data in the form, it just sort of strings it out a lot. That's one idea. Yes, sir?
There's not necessarily a way to encrypt the URL.
There's no way to encrypt the URL itself. And, encrypt is maybe not the right word here. Because if we're using plain HTTP, things are not encrypted anyway. If we're using HTTPS, the URL will be encrypted when it is sent over the network. But think about the user, right? The user sees what's in the address bar pretty easily. Maybe we don't want to reveal to the user exactly what we're sending. It's not great security, but the post method does keep that out of the user's eyes. That's one thing. It's just one reason. Questions? All right, we're now on slide 30. I'm going to mention this from time to time so that the audio can be calibrated with the slides. You need to do that. Okay, so HTTP 1.1, in addition to having this idea of the connection keep alive and reusable connections, added some additional methods. There's a put method and a delete method. You can actually use HTTP to manage files on the server. Not too many people do that. There's something called the WebDAV protocol that does that. But these days, I don't see a lot of use of the put and delete methods, although, actually, probably, I don't remember. The turn-in page may use the put method to upload things. But there are other ways of doing it, too, so I don't know. I don't remember what I did there. Could be. Okay, what do response messages look like? Remember, we looked at request messages, response messages. They have the same general structure. They start with the protocol name. There's no method now. We don't need that. And then there's a numerical response code. And I think the next slide has a bunch of them listed. 200. And they're pretty arbitrary. They make no intuitive sense whatsoever. They just are what they are. You look them up and you need to know them. So 200 means okay. And so there's the numerical code and then a string that says what it is. And then come a bunch of headers, and I think the only one that is really essential is content length. Right? It says how many bytes are going to be in the body that comes after the end of the header. Okay? And why do we need to know that? Think about this now from a programming perspective, and think about it from the perspective of TCP being a reliable byte stream with no message boundaries.
You need to know how much data you're going to receive.
You need to know how much data to read.
There's no standard format for the body, so you have no line that says the end.
Exactly. There's nothing that HTTP knows about the body here, which is this part, that would tell it how long it is apart from this header. And when you're writing a web browser, of course, I want to display a page, I have to know when I got to the end of it. So this length, the web browser parses and interprets that into a number, and then it makes sure it reads that much data after the header, and then it knows it's done and can display it. Okay. There's another scheme for encoding where the end is called chunked encoding that will be, again, something that you investigate in the final project in the course. That will be something that we get to later, but for now, just think of it as the HTTP contains enough information for the web browser to know where the end of the page is. Okay, the status codes, 200 okay, 301 moved, which means that the web browser has provided a header that says where it moved to. Bad request, not well formed, the famous 404 errors. I'm sure you've all seen the number 404. Why is it 404? Who knows? But we all know that 404 means not found. It's shown up in our browsers from time to time. And 505 HTTP version not supported. I hope we're not seeing any browsers that have that problem anymore. Chaos was around for a while. Okay, so those are just examples. There are a lot more of those. Now, I was going to... We may be able to do this if I do the following.
not. Here. Here. I had it all set up to do on the Windows installation in the laptop, and I'm going to bet that I don't have Telnet installed. I do have Telnet installed. Excellent. Okay. So, because HTTP is a text protocol, we can use the Telnet application, which is really just a remote terminal connection, to play like we are a web browser and interact directly with a web server. So instead of asking our browser to fetch something, we will sort of directly ask the web server and see what we get back in return. Okay? So let me see now. I do have this problem that I can't see and type at the same time. So let's try Telnet. Okay. So the telnet command, it's not typically installed in Windows default installations, but if you go into configure the Windows installation menu, telnet client will be one of the things that you could check there. And I think on Linux systems, it's also typically not installed anymore, because like FTP, Telnet is essentially insecure. And the reason that we're going to feel comfortable using it for this purpose is that we're not doing anything that requires security. Right? So, but normally, if you're wanting to interact with a system, Telnet is not the way to do it. You want to use Secure Shell, which is encrypted connections. Anyway, here we go. Okay, now I'm going to type get slash, I just want the root page, and I have to type the slash 1.1. I have to type the protocol like that, and then I have to type the host header, host space, and it's www.eecs.wsu.edu. Okay, nothing happens. Server hasn't replied. Why not?
It replied.
Oh, request timeout. Okay, it had not replied because I had not typed the blank line that comes at the end of the request. All right, so I didn't like that. So I guess I have to type faster. Get slash HTTP slash 1.1 enter host colon www too many W's dot EECS dot WSU dot EDU enter. There we go. Bad request. I put. What did I do?
You had www.
Oh, I had backslash dot e. What? I had four. Wow. Okay. Well, anyway. All right. It doesn't matter. If you succeed in doing this, you will actually see that even when you type it right, you will get a move permanently response from www.eecs.wsu.edu, and it will tell you that you need to go to school.eecs.wsu.edu. Why not? That's what they did. And if you try school.eecs.wsu.edu, it will also say moved permanently, and this one confused me a bit.
it will say move to an HTTPS server, all right, which we can't interact with Telnet. Right? That's the secure version of HTTP. Telnet doesn't do that. So at that point, we're sort of stuck. We can't actually get the content off of EECS by using Telnet. Anyway, okay? So you can, it would be worth a little bit of playing just to get your fingers associated with this and get your mind studying what you see here. Connection close, right? It says content length, fine. Connection close, which says we're not going to reuse the connection. And it says content type is text HTML. Okay, so the content type is header is part of the HTTP protocol, but what content type you send is not. So this says it's HTML, and this indeed looks like HTML. So HTML is not part of HTTP. It's separate. They're just sort of linked together by HTTP tells us that it's HTML, and then we have to go look at the HTML specification to understand what comes after that. Questions? Okay, so take a look at that stuff. So now we're going to go back to here. Maybe? Yes? We will get around to using Wireshark later in the class. So we're not going to do that right now. All right, so I said... So I said that there's, even though there's no state in the HTTP protocol, HTTP supports state using something called cookies. So why cookies? This is a cultural thing. This is a reference to sort of the cultural understanding of a magic cookie. Now, I don't know if that extends to other cultures, so people who come from other cultures may not understand that. But sort of in the mythology of Western European Grimm's fairy tales and so forth, the idea of a magic cookie is around, right? So that's the idea of using the word cookie in this context. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Cookies are just little bits of data that are identified as cookies. There's a cookie header line, remember in the headers, cookie one, and then some data, right? And you can put that in a request, in which case the client is telling the server something, or you can put it in a response, in which case the server is telling the client something. And what happens is when the server has sent you a cookie, then later when you make a response, you send back the cookie. And what does this do? It lets the server associate the earlier request with the later one. The earlier response with the later request. Yeah?
So how are cookies used for tracking and stuff?
Okay, so how are they used for tracking and stuff? So there are different kinds of cookies. Some cookies are just kept by the browser in its working memory and sent back as long as that browser session is open. Other cookies actually get written into files. They're called permanent cookies. And so a cookie that the server sent you 5 days ago may be sent back today, right? And now the server knows that you're the same person that contacted them 5 days ago. And then there are cross-site cookies and all kinds of other things that let people do tracking of where you've been. But it's this idea that the server has given you something that you have stored and then are sending back that allows all of this to happen, including the tracking. Good question. Okay. So there's a picture on the next slide. So this picture is going to describe how permanent cookies work. We have the client, the server, we have a cookie file for eBay, and when we make our request, in response. So notice that the eBay cookie is not sent to Amazon. The initial request here does not contain the eBay cookie because we're sending to Amazon. Amazon responds with a cookie, and when we make a request to Amazon, that cookie is included, and so Amazon knows that was us. Etc. All right. So yeah.
So our cookies also use passwords. So my browser knows my password.
So no, cookies are not used to store passwords. Cookies, passwords are stored in a local database based on the things that you enter directly. Okay. So it's another database, but it's not something that comes back from the server. It's something that you've entered.
Could a server carry cookies as well?
Could a server carry cookies? Well, the server is the server here is remembering the 1678 cookie, right? The client doesn't generate a new cookie and send it to the server. The server generates the cookie and sends it to the client. Was that the sense of your question? I'm not sure I got it.
I think kind of. So in that case, a client could never, or wouldn't make sense for a client to generate a cookie, then it has to be from the server?
It has to be, the cookie mechanism works with the server generating the cookie.
Yeah, okay.
If you're doing something where the server wants the client to do something, then that will have to be in other headers or in the body of the request. I think there was another question.
Is the cookie involved with the session with the server?
So cookies are the way sessions are implemented.
Okay.
So if you sort of dig into the Clix protocol, it uses cookies extensively to manage each of your sessions. So once you logged in, your browser is remembering your cookie. And remember, there was a question a while back. People came in the next day and said, "Oh, I'm already logged in." Well, that was because your browser still had the cookie from before, and the server still had the cookie from before. And what I do when I'm on my game is tell the server to forget all the cookies between one class and the next, forcing you to log in again. Okay? Yeah.
So what kind of information would it contain?
The cookie is just data. Essentially, it's whatever you want to put in it, whatever length you want to make it. If you look at the cookies for Clix, they are just sort of arbitrary, random looking strings of characters. And what's interesting about Clix is that it actually generates a new cookie for each interaction. So not only does it know sort of how, it knows whether you've responded to a particular point. But yes, they're just big long strings. Brian's next, I think.
So is it the browser that has the intelligence to delete the old cookies? So like if you need a new cookie from the server, does the browser know to delete the old cookie?
So this is actually a very, very perceptive question and relevant. So the rule is that cookies can have lifetimes associated with them, in which case the browser will sort of stop sending them after the cookie's lifetime is over. But the rule generally is that if you have a valid cookie that is still valid, you send it. The reason this is relevant is because I have this continuing problem interacting with my wsu.edu, in which I get to a point where when I go to log in, it says, you just logged out. And then when I click log in again, it takes me to an Oracle sign page instead of the actual MyWSU sign-in page, and the sign-in does not work. And the only thing that I've found that fixes this is to go into my browser's cookie manager. Firefox, in this case, has a cookie manager feature on its setting page and allows you to delete cookies. And so what I do is I go say, select all the WSU cookies, delete them, and then I can log in again, right? So there's something screwy about the way the cookies are being managed on the server side that causes it to misbehave when it gets a bad cookie. Or it gets an old cookie.
I get that too.
You get that too. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, now see, I've taught you how to recover from that situation. Go into your settings in your browser, go to the cookie manager where you are allowed to delete cookies, select all the WSU ones and get rid of them, and things will be good again. I finally learned this. It took me 18 months, so and calling tech support doesn't help. Yeah.
So that's the reason why when you call like tech supports back in the old days, they'd be like, well, did you delete all of your browser?
Did you delete all of your cookies? Right. Right. And WSU tech support wants me to reinstall my browser and other crazy stuff, or create new profiles, one way of getting rid of the problem, but it'll come back, I'm sure. All right, buy a new computer. There we go. Reinstall the operating system. Why not? Okay. So what are they used for? This is how you keep state, right? This is how the server knows about state associated with client. All right. Next topic is caches. So you've all had 260 or EE234. I don't know if this is covered in 234, but it should have been covered in 260, right? Where do we find caches in computer systems? In the processor, right? There's a processor cache. Sometimes in the memory system, there are additional levels of caching between the processor and the actual memory, and they're used to what? Speed up access to memory. Okay? That one. That's what that one is used for. What would be another place there's a cache?
Browsers.
Yeah, we'll get to the browser.
Graphics storage.
File system, right? Typically, an operating system will set aside some of the memory, which is slow by the process standards because the processor requires even more caches in front of the memory. But the memory is much faster than the disk, so there's another cache set aside into which blocks from the file system can be read, and then when we go to use them again, they're there and they're much faster to access than they would be on the disk. So, same idea. With the web, when we go out and fetch something like the homepage of CNN, what do we get? We get a lot of pictures. We get something called style sheets that say how things are supposed to be laid out. There's a lot of stuff that, if I refresh the page, is going to be the same as it was before. Right? And a cache is a way for the browser or a explicit proxy server on the network to avoid having to make those network requests. Remember, network requests take a long time. They're sort of 50 milliseconds round trip, and then plus the data transfer time and all that. So if I can avoid making those requests, I can display things faster. And the discussion here is in terms of an explicit proxy server that sits on the network, but the same idea applies to caches that exist within the browsers themselves. So the idea is we're wanting a page, we say, do we have a copy of it locally, either in the proxy server or in the browser, and if so, serve it from there. And otherwise make the request to the actual server. So proxy server doesn't have it. The cool thing about a proxy server is an explicit proxy server on the network is that it can be shared between multiple clients, although these days there are so many websites that people are using, it's not clear to me that local, that network caches shared between people are all that effective, because I don't think we do the same things enough to make that worthwhile. But certainly our own browsers caches are worthwhile. Oh. Can you think of any problems with a cache like this that could arise? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. What if the web page has been updated since you last fetched it? They thought of that in this design. And there are a couple of things that can be done. One is, again, a page can come with a caching lifetime associated with it. And so the proxy server will forget the page after a certain amount of time. And then the other thing that used to have to do more than you seem to have to do now is that you can make a request in such a way that it forces the request to go through to the original server. And I think, in a lot of browsers, what you do, Control-R to refresh a page. And I think if you do Control-Shift-R, it will force it to go through all the way to the origin server. Okay? All right. So how much does a cache help? And this is the same analysis that you would have done in 260, that you will do in 360, or maybe in 360 or at 460. Anytime you run into a caching situation, we want to know how much it helps. And so we have to think about, well, what would it be like if we didn't have the cache, and what would it be like if we did? And the data that goes into these calculations are typically how long does it take you to get the uncached thing versus how long does it take you to get the cached thing, right? And typically, for the internet, we would see ratios there of 100 or 1,000 to 1, perhaps. And the so-called hit rate or miss rate, which is how many of the objects that you're requesting are in the cache versus how many do you actually have to go to the origin to get. And so this little example says, says that we're making 15 requests per second of 100,000 DIP objects, and therefore the browsers are requesting 1.5 megabits per second of data. And in addition, this is all going into sort of how long does it take to go to the origin server. In addition, the round trip time is 2 seconds. Well, that's pretty terrible, but for purposes of illustration, it'll do. And the access link rate is 1.54 megabits per second. And there's one other assumption here, which is that the ten megabits per second. Yes. It says we're using 15% locally, but we're using 1.5 megabits out of the 1.54 megabits, so that's 99% utilization. When you have 99% utilization, what happens? Of a link, what happens? Congestion, which leads to
queues,
which leads to big delays, right? And packet loss. All right. So that change should be becoming natural, right? Right. High utilization, queuing, delays, loss. Okay. So 2 seconds for the round trip time plus minutes. Yeah. Big queues, perhaps. Plus microseconds on the local network. How to fix it? Get a faster network. I'm over time. Sorry. Get a faster network or install a cache. So next time we will go through the calculations associated with that. All right. Thanks. Sorry for the confusion. There'll only be an audio file today that you'll have to look at along with the slides.